Okay, so let us reorient ourselves. Where are we in this course? Remember, our strategy for the next few lectures is going to be this. We start with a Klein-Gordon theory, where the field is not yet quantized. Then we do the Legendre transform from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formalism. Still, the field is not quantized. The field is just number valued. In the Lagrangian formalism, and just to review, the right-hand side is going to be all Lagrangian formalism. The left column is all Hamiltonian formalism. On the right-hand side, in the Lagrangian formalism, we have the advantage that we can write things in a covariant way, in a manifestly covariant way, to accommodate special relativity. And then from there, we generalize, we allow curvature, and go to general relativity. Still, the field is number valued at this point. So now everything is covariant. The Klein-Gordon theory lives in space-time of general relativity. But what we need is Hamiltonians and commutation relations in order to quantize the theory. So we take this covariant formulation and do a Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian column. And there, the theory is still covariant because it is just a reformulation of that covariant theory. But in this formulation, it's no longer obvious that it's covariant. And in this formulation, we have a field and a canonically conjugate field. So now we can impose canonical commutation relations and define Hilbert spaces, and we can do the quantization as usual. So then we end up here with the full quantum field theory on curved space.
Is it obvious that after the quantization, the theory still stays covariant? Do you have not introduced some anomalies and stuff?
That's a good point. In this case, it will work out. But it is true that as a general matter, yes, there are so-called anomalies, which is the case where a classical theory has a symmetry that the quantum theory does not have, where the symmetry is broken, basically because the quantum fluctuations don't respect that symmetry. A classical theory only lives on the extreme action surface, and there may be symmetries that are not there of it. So in this case, the problem will not arise, but in quantum field theory for particle physics, that's definitely a concern. And it's an important consideration when you build quantum field theories for particle physics, when you study how many families of particles there are, and what kind of forces, what kind of flavors of particles there are, then sometimes the building of the standard model of particle physics has been guided by the principle that a symmetry should persist even to the quantum theory, often because the symmetries are important to ensure that the theory is renormalizable or that the theory has certain symmetries that we observe in nature. Okay, so today we will do this step and that step. The Legendre transform will be a transform that is just like the Fourier transform, completely agnostic to what it is applied to. So we will do the Legendre transform. There is no such thing as a non-covariant Legendre transform and a covariant one, just like the Fourier transform. It can be applied anywhere. So the Legendre transform as well. And so the very same kind of map will be applied here as there. So we only need to do it once, and then we know also how to apply it backwards. We just need to learn how to do that for fields. And we started that already in the previous lecture. Okay, so we had already started the step one, where we begin with a Hamiltonian of a Klein-Gordon field. And it is expressed in terms of the field and its canonically conjugate momentum field. But remember that they are not operator valued just yet. They are still just number valued, real number valued functions. So it's a classical field theory. So we have variables phi of x and variables pi of x. Then we do a Legendre transform, and I'm indicating that with a capital T, the Legendre transform goes this way to the Lagrangian formulation, and then there's an inverse Legendre transform that gets us back to the Hamiltonian formulation. So the Legendre transform in this direction from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian proceeds by replacing the variable pi, or the variables pi of x, by new variables that we will call beta of x and t. And as usual, the new variable in the process of Legendre transforming is defined by differentiating the function with respect to the variable that needs replacing. So beta is the functional derivative of h with respect to pi. Remember, h is a functional. You feed it a function. In fact, you feed it two functions, phi of x and pi of x, and you get a number out. There is an integral involved in this. The Hamiltonian is an integral over the phi, the pi, and their derivatives. Okay, so after we do this Legendre transform, we obtain the Lagrangian. And remember, the Lagrangian is given by the integral over new variables times old variables, so the beta times the pi minus the h. And if we want to do the Legendre transform backwards, we simply apply another Legendre transform because it is its own inverse. So we take the Lagrangian functional, and now we want to replace the variable beta, so we differentiate with L with respect to beta, and we obtain a new variable that we might call gamma, but as we proved last time, actually this gamma is going to be the pi again. So the Legendre transform, or also the inverse Legendre transform, defines as a new variable what used to be the pi, and also the Legendre transformed function of L turns out to be h again. Okay, so capital T stands for the forward Legendre transform and T inverse for the reverse Fourier Legendre transform. Now, we had studied the Legendre transform in isolation. We only looked at how it transforms variables and the functions. But for us, these are more than just arbitrary functions. They are the functions h and l that generate the equations of motion. So we can now ask, if h generates certain equations of motion, then what equations of motion does that imply for the Legendre transform? And vice versa, which equations of motion here correspond to the equations of motion over there? So basically, what is the transformation of the equations of motion? And we won't derive that. I'll just give you the result and then prove it. So on the Hamiltonian side, the Hamiltonian generates these two equations of motion, the time derivative of phi and the time derivative of pi, given as usual by the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to pi and the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to phi with a minus sign, as you hopefully remember from classical mechanics or our previous lecture. So these are the two equations of motion. Let's call them h1 and h2. And then on the Lagrangian side, we have that this Lagrangian is also inducing equations of motion, namely these two. Phi dot is beta, and dl by d phi is d by dt of dl by d beta. Remember that the Lagrangian really has also two independent variables, phi and beta. And then, as it happens, because of an equation of motion, it turns out that the beta is also phi dot. So we have these two equations of motion here, L1 and L2. This means that the claim is that if you start with this Hamiltonian generating these equations of motion, then under the Legendre transform, this Lagrangian defined by the Legendre transform gives us these equations of motion, and vice versa. So these two equations plus the Legendre transform imply those two equations, and those two equations, in addition to the Legendre transform, gives us these two equations. And I should say that even though this looks as if we were still doing special relativity or just a case without curvature, No, this is completely general. It will be exactly like this, also with all the trimmings of general relativity. It's just that. And that's, and of course, it will be quite non-trivial when you actually work out what that is, what, for example, the dh by d pi is. That will be a little bit messy. And also on the right-hand side. And all the more it's important that we keep track of everything. For example, that there really is a beta and that this is an extra equation and so on. So let's prove this, at least in one direction. So let's say we want to show that, I mean, overall what we want to show is that these two equations, h1 and h2, this is the logical symbol for and. So the two equations, h1 and h2, together with the Legendre transform, give us the two equations L1 and L2, and vice versa. These two imply also those two. So let's prove it one way. For example, given these two, then with the Legendre transform, we claim that we get L1 and L2. And then I leave it to you as an exercise to prove the other direction. OK, so let's say we want to show L1. Oh, it's a pity that we have only one screen here. So this is L1. Let's say we want to show that one. So we can start with phi dot. You have to show that phi dot is beta. So we show that we start with this. Phi dot is by the first Hamilton equation. It is dh by d pi. It's dh by d pi. But then if we look up what the Legendre transform does, dh by d pi is beta. So therefore, we indeed obtain L1. We obtain that phi dot by the first Hamilton equation is dh by d pi, but by the Legendre transform, dh by d pi is beta. So we have L1. Now we still have to show that h1 and h2 together with the Legendre transform also imply L2. Well, let's do this. OK. So d by dt of dl by d beta is what? The claim is that d by dt dl by d beta is dl by d phi. So let's see. If we use the inverse Legendre transform, then we see that dl by d beta, so if we take the Lagrangian and differentiate it with respect to the variable beta, then we obtain the new variable pi. That's the first step of doing the Legendre transform backwards, right? So remember, that was up here. dl by d beta is pi, if you want to go that way, right? So we have this. D by dt of dl by d beta is d by dt of pi. But then by the second Hamilton equation, we have that the tan derivative of pi is minus dh by d phi. That's literally the second Hamilton equation. And now let us write out what h is in terms of the Legendre transform. So the Legendre transform tells us that the Hamiltonian is the integral over new variables times old variables, or this is old variable times new variable, integrated over all pairs of them, minus the old function. So let's work that out. We have to differentiate with respect to phi. So we have a minus d by d phi of all of this. So that gives us a minus d by d phi of this thing here. But that has only a phi dependence in here. So we get a d beta by d phi times pi. So this term differentiated with respect to phi just gives us that. And then in here, we have two occurrences of phi that we need to differentiate, that we need to take into account when differentiating. So we have the direct derivative of dl by d phi, dl by d phi, plus indirect dependence. Then we can differentiate dl by d beta, dl by d beta, and then d beta by d phi. Dl by d beta is pi by the Legendre transform equations. So what we have is pi times d beta by d phi. Here we have minus pi d beta by d phi. So those two terms cancel each other out. And we're just left with dl by d phi. And therefore, this is equal to that. And that's the second Euler-Lagrange equation that we had to prove. Yeah, and similarly, you can prove the other direction. Okay, so our result so far is that the Legendre transform from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formulation allows us to rewrite the equations of motion from the Hamiltonian way to the Lagrangian way, where they look like this. dl by d phi is d by dt dl by d beta, what we just proved, and then that's what we proved a little bit earlier. Now, it doesn't look like that helped much, because that doesn't look very covariant, does it? It's just time derivatives. Where are the space derivatives? How can this ever be covariant? So we have to massage these equations a little bit more in order to get them into a manifestly covariant formulation. And then we can introduce curvature and all that. So let's analyze L1 and L2, the two Lagrangian equations. In our equation here, this one, in this equation of motion here, let us look at what that really is. We are differentiating here L with respect to phi. But there are two kinds of occurrences of phi in the Lagrangian. There are direct occurrences of phi in the Lagrangian, for example, in the term m squared phi squared. A direct occurrence. But phi also occurs with spatial derivatives. So for example, the x1 derivative or the x2 derivative of phi also occurs in the Lagrangian. That's from the Laplacian. So what about that? Well, it turns out that these derivatives in space are also implicitly differentiated about in here. And that ultimately will make the whole thing covariant. Because this is not only a functional derivative with respect to an undecorated occurrence of phi, but it's also a functional derivative with respect to all other occurrences of phi, such as the spatial derivatives of phi. I'll show you in a sec why they are automatically included. It's not because I'm legislating that now, but because we've done it this way all along. Just perhaps weren't aware of it. Whereas the field beta just arises in one way. So the claim is, yes?
By that you are assuming there are no mixed, like higher order time derivative or time space derivative mixed. You are taking the simplest Lagrangian that you have written in the...
Yes. Eventually, we will upgrade this today, and we will allow for all sorts of things. Okay. So my point so far is that the term dl by d phi is the total derivative with respect to all occurrences of phi in the Lagrangian, including differentiated versions of phi. And that's because of the way we defined what the functional derivative is. So what was the functional derivative? Remember how we defined what d by d phi is. By definition, the functional derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the field phi of x and t is the Newton-Leibniz limit, epsilon going to 0, 1 over epsilon. And then you take the Lagrangian, and you plug in the field, well, and the beta, but I'm not listing the beta separately. You plug in the field, phi, but shifted. So it's the variable plus shifted by epsilon, right? It's the at x where you want to differentiate. That's where you add the Dirac delta. Remember, if this were a discrete set of variables, then that would be a Kronecker delta. It's just saying that we are shifting one of the variables. And in this case, it's the Dirac delta. So we replace the argument phi by phi plus epsilon Dirac delta, and then we subtract the functional evaluated at phi itself without any shift. Now let's do this in the case where the phi occurs differentiated with respect to space. In order to keep things simple, let me give you an example where we strip off all the multidimensionality and stuff like that. Let's consider a functional f, which is a functional of a function u on the real line. That's a little simpler than here where everything is functions of three coordinates and the time. So f of u shall be that functional. Okay, so it's the integral over the sine of x times the space derivative of u integrated over x, over all x. Now, let's see what the functional derivative is of our capital F functional with respect to u of x. One might think it's zero because u of x doesn't occur undecorated. It occurs only with the derivative. But actually, it does occur. The derivative doesn't prevent us from seeing that the u of x is in there. Let's just calculate straightforwardly what this definition gives us. So what comes out of this is the following. We take that functional, and we take the derivative that acts on u of x, and by integration by parts, we have it act on the other side. And we get the same functional. We're assuming here that the asymptotics of u of x is such that there are no boundary terms. So if we do integration by parts, then this derivative will act on the sine instead of the u of x. Then we have the functional in the form of the integral of the cosine of x times the function. And now we see clearly that, well, u of x occurs directly, and the functional derivative clearly must give us then a minus cosine of x. So the functional derivative wasn't zero. Instead, differentiating with respect to u here somehow magically produced a derivative on everything else in the functional. What that means is that as I announced a little earlier, when we write down dl by d phi, this will imply non-trivial differentiations of phi to also count, to also appear in the Euler Lagrange equations. So let's do this systematically. Let's ask, is there a systematic way to evaluate the functional derivatives with respect to differentiated functions? See, what we saw here is this. If there hadn't been a derivative, then the functional derivative of capital F with respect to u would have been simply sine of x. But there is a derivative, and as a consequence, we have that the functional derivative of f with respect to u gives us minus of the cosine. Now, what if we had here higher powers of derivatives, for example? Then what would be the functional derivative? Is there a way to anticipate, to write down immediately, what the functional derivative is of a functional with respect to functions which occur differentiated in the functional? There are two ways to do this. We can either do integration by parts like that, as we did here, or we can plug the functional differentiation directly into that formula, which we will also do in a moment. But either way, it can get a little tedious if you have to do lots of functional differentiation. So I'll show you now a way to go directly from the functional to its functional derivative when the function occurs in a differentiated way. So here's a lemma, meaning a little theorem. What it says is that if we have a functional z, and the functional is a functional of a function f of this form, it's the integral over a polynomial in derivatives of f. In our case, it'll generally be a polynomial of degree 2 at most. But we can cover it very generally. So imagine that the functional is of this particular form. So it could be just d by dx of f squared or something like that. And the claim is that the functional derivative of this functional with respect to f is minus d by dx of the functional derivative of z with respect to the derivative of f, where now this is viewed as its own variable. So if we differentiate the functional with respect to the derivative using the Newton-Leibniz formula with this as an independent variable, then we just have to put a minus d by dx in front, and then we obtain the same as if we had taken the functional derivative and then just worked everything out with the Newton-Leibniz limit for f itself. So for example, let's say we take the functional z of f, which is just the integral over the square of the space derivatives. Now let's evaluate it according to the lemma. So in this case, d by dx f is to be viewed as its own variable, as its own field. Then what do we obtain when we functional differentiate? So we differentiate z with respect as a function of dx f with respect to dx f. And then clearly, that just gives us that the integral goes away, the 2 comes in front, and we just have 2 d by dx of f of x. That's just the derivative of z with respect to this variable. Now, the lemma says that the functional derivative of z with respect to f, so the proper thing, the thing that we will need for our equations of motion, that is minus d by dx, and I'm just using a notation that is often used instead of writing d over dx, we can also write simply partial x. It's the same thing, it's just a little faster to write. So according to the lemma, that integral, that functional derivative, is obtained also in that way. You take minus d by dx of the functional derivative of z with respect to the derivative viewed as its own variable. And here we already carried out that part. We now simply have to take minus the derivative of it. So we take this result, because that's that, and then we apply minus the derivative on it. So we get minus 2 second derivative f of x. So the claim is that the functional derivative of this z with respect to f is given by that, minus 2 second derivative of f. And we calculated it in this case using the lemma. So we viewed this as a functional of d by dx f. That functional derivative is easy. It's just 2 times d by dx f. And then we used the lemma, which tells us that in order to get what we really want, we just have to apply a minus d by dx in front of it. And so we arrived at that result. Now, let us verify that same result from first principles. So we take our functional and differentiate it with respect to f using Newton-Leibniz. So what is that? Remember the functional was the space derivative of f squared. So what do we have to do? We have to take the limit, epsilon going to 0, 1 over epsilon, and we take the space derivative of f plus the shift, epsilon, square the whole thing, minus the functional unchanged. As usual, the terms that do not depend on epsilon, namely this term squared and that term squared, cancel each other out, because that one comes with the plus and that one with the minus. The term with which is epsilon squared goes away, because we have epsilon squared divided by epsilon. It's just epsilon. For epsilon going to 0, that vanishes. And the only term that's left over is the term that's linear in epsilon, which is a factor of this times a factor of that. And then the epsilon cancels away. So overall, we get a factor of this and a factor of that. So it's, and twice because this is squared. So we obtain that this is twice the integral, a derivative of f times the derivative of the delta. Then we do integration by parts. This derivative then moves to the left, picks up a minus sign. The boundary term is neglected. And now the Dirac delta is freed up. It's no longer differentiated. It's freed up. So we can integrate out the dx prime variable. Everything just depends on x now. And we obtain it's minus 2 second derivative of f, which is what we also had obtained using the lemma. OK, and in this way, you can prove it for any polynomial. OK, so it seems we are almost there. Remember, why did we do this? We wanted to get the space derivatives out in the open. They shouldn't just be hidden there, because the equation of motion that we got from the Legendre transform only involved time derivatives. I mean, they showed only time derivatives. But we want a framework that is explicitly, directly covariant. So we need space derivatives. OK, so this was the equation of motion as it arose from the Legendre transform, from the Hamiltonian formalism. And now let us use the lemma. And using the lemma, we can do the following. We can take the Lagrangian, which originally is viewed as a functional of phi and of beta. And we have to differentiate that with respect to phi. And remember, that means with respect to all occurrences of phi. It's automatically picked up if we work with the Newton-Leibniz limit, because phi gets simply shifted by epsilon times the Dirac delta. And if phi is differentiated, then everything is differentiated. So we take this Lagrangian and view it now not just as a functional of phi and beta, but we view it now as a functional of phi alone, undecorated, and a functional of all the spatial derivatives of phi and beta and t. So dL by d phi is, when this is the proper Newton-Leibniz limit, where phi is the independent variable, is also the same as if we differentiate L with respect to the direct occurrences of phi, but also with respect to the indirect occurrences of phi using the lemma. So we differentiate dL by dj of phi. But in order to get the right thing, we also have to have minus d by dx j of that using the lemma.
So on the right-hand side, can we still not view the derivative as a partial derivative in some formal sense?
Sorry, which one? This one or that one?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, but these are functional derivatives.
But at this point, we still can't view it as a partial derivative the way we do it in naively in classical field theory, because Euler Lagrange equation is all partial derivatives, right?
I'm not sure what do you mean by that. If it's not partial derivative, what else would it be? You see, we are considering these to be independent variables now. See, the lemma says you can either consider phi to be the independent variable, and then you have to use the Newton-Leibniz limit for phi, and you pick up everything automatically. Or you can view your independent variables to be phi, d by dx1 phi, d by dx2 phi, d by dx3 phi. But then you need the lemma to give you the right answer. Namely, then you have to have this minus d by dx as well.
I think what you mean is in classical mechanics, the Lagrangian is not a functional.
No, as in if you do classical field theory, even then you're differentiating Lagrangian as if the field itself is like a single variable.
Yeah. I think the only point is that we tend to use a notation where instead of doing this functional, we just write it as partial. It is understood that we are taking a functional derivative.
Yeah,
but that partial is supposed to mean that we are treating everything as an independent, all the derivatives as an independent.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
I think that's just a notation.
Okay, so this is not the equation of motion just yet. This is just rewriting what this is. The L by d phi, the total derivative, consists of all those derivatives with respect, partial derivatives with respect to the various independent variables in here. So the equation of motion then takes this form. Maybe let's just quickly go back to where the equation of motion is. The equation of motion is here. The L by d phi, that's what we just reformulated, is equal to d by dt of the L by d beta. So we can now write that the L by d phi minus d by dxj of the L by d space derivatives of phi is equal to the right-hand side of the equation of motion, d by dt of the L by d beta. Okay, so the left-hand side could also be written simply as the L by d phi. But then it means phi is the independent variable alone. But if we spell everything out, if we write the dependence here as a dependence of phi and d by dj phi, then using the lemma, the term dl by d phi becomes really all of these. Mm. And that's nice because now we have space derivatives and a time derivative, and it looks like we have a chance of getting this thing covariant. Especially because the beta, by one of the equations of motion, by L1, is phi dot. So it all looks very symmetric at this point already. And especially, this looks very inviting because remember how we arrived at this. We started with the L by d phi, and then we said the L by d phi has hidden in it the derivatives with respect to the space derivatives of phi as well. So what we did is we took this one elegant term, the L by d phi that contained all of the functional derivatives. And then we split it up into a derivative with respect to the direct dependence on phi here, and the derivatives with respect to the indirect dependencies on phi over there. Come on in. So now it seems that we have, because of the equation of motion, also this term here. So in principle, it looks like we can just move this term to the left-hand side, or that one to the right-hand side. Either way, no, let's say we move this one to the left-hand side. And then we upgrade everything from just space derivatives also to time derivatives. And then we can just take all of these terms together and obtain a super elegant formulation, which is that the equation of motion is dl by d phi is equal to zero, where now we are picking up not just the space derivatives, but also the time derivatives. Right? So we just move. Remember, these two terms can be written as one term if we say that the independent variable is just phi. Or we can spell it out, and then we get that. Can't we just take the time derivatives now as well on this side and then compress everything into just the L by d phi equal to zero? Almost. We can almost do it, but there's still something missing. So can we write dl by d phi is equal to zero now in a space-time sense? And unfortunately, we cannot. And the reason is that in order to apply the lemma, if you remember, we need an integral in there. And we don't have an integral in time for L. L has only a spatial integral, not a time integral. So we cannot apply the lemma backwards to integrate also the time derivative term into the Lagrangian, alone. But that's not a problem. Oh, let me just remind you of what the lemma was. The lemma said that if you have a functional of a function that is of the form integral dx, polynomial of the derivative, then if you worked it out with the Newton-Leibniz formula, etc., you get a certain result that you can also obtain by simply functionally differentiating your functional with respect to this viewed as its own independent variable, But the price you have to pay is that the outcome of all of that still has to be differentiated and multiplied with minus 1. Get the same thing, right? But you needed that there was an integration to start with. But we don't have a time integral. So we can't integrate, we can't put the time derivative, the beta, the phi dot, we can't put that into the same picture. We can't absorb that, into the L. Okay? But that's obviously easy to fix. All we have to do is add another time integration, right? And then we go from the Lagrangian formulation to the action. So the action functional is just like the Lagrangian functional, but it's integrated also over time. And this is now the action, it's called the action of the field evolution phi of x and t. So this thing spits out a number if you feed it not just a field configuration, but a field evolution. You need to feed it phi of x and t because you're actually integrating over all t. And then you can use the lemma backwards. And then you have that the equations of motion can be written in this way, or also using the lemma backwards, you can write them as simply ds by d phi is equal to 0. But here it has to be understood that phi is the only independent variable in this. And you do get effectively all the space and time derivatives of phi involved as well simply by the Newton-Leibniz formula. Or you can say that my s depends on phi directly, for example, through the m squared phi squared term in the action, but also indirectly through its space derivatives and time derivatives. In this case, if you write your action as a functional of phi and the derivatives, and you treat it as such, so you functionally differentiate as such, then you get these equations of motion. So the difference between the two is the way you interpret what your independent variables are. Fundamentally, this is how you do it. But you can save yourself some trouble with having to do integration by parts, etc., by writing it in this way, because all of that is already done if you use the lemma. So just a moment. So the upshot is that the Hamiltonian equations of motion can now also be reformulated in this elegant way, simply by saying that ds by d phi is equal to 0. Which is to say that the classical field evolutions are those field evolutions for which the action is stationary. And a small change of the field evolution, the value of the action, which is, remember, just a number, the value would change very little. It is extremal. That's what this says. Was a question?
I think that between this equation and the yellow box and an equation a couple of slides back, change the full derivative with respect to time into a partial derivative with respect to time. I'm not sure if
that's important. Yes, no, it doesn't mean a thing. Okay. I'm not really distinguishing here between the d by dx and the del by del x. Nope, there's no difference.
Shouldn't it be because doesn't the phi depend on time as well? So a partial derivative would be a
partial derivative. Yeah, you see, the thing is this, that the del has two meanings in mathematical physics. On one hand, you use the del if there are multiple variables, for example. And then it's just, well, there are multiple variables, then for some reason you use the del instead of the d. But it is also used when you have a direct and indirect dependence. And so, I don't know, I just use them interchangeably. And I hope it's clear from the context what's meant. It's just that the notation is not unique in its own.
Okay. In its own. In this case, it doesn't matter because the x doesn't depend on the t.
Yeah. Okay, so classical physics can be described as is encapsulated in that equation. The classical evolution of a field is an evolution which extremizes the action. And that solution is not unique. For any initial condition, there's going to be a solution like that. But all of the classical solutions obey that. And in quantum mechanics, you know, the path integral will show that the field, in principle, undergoes every evolution. We discussed it a little bit last time. It undergoes every evolution. And what that means is that effectively we're doing a Fourier transform. Now, in the Fourier transform, as we discussed last time, those configurations that we sum over in the Fourier transform, for which the phase in this rapidly oscillating integral is stationary, will contribute most. And we calculated last time that those configurations for which it is stationary are obtained by the Legendre transform. Remember, the Legendre transform picks from the Fourier integral just the stationary phase component. And that was another way of seeing that classical mechanics arises as the stationary phase approximation from quantum mechanics. Okay, but we are not going to do the path integral formulation until the very end of the course. We're going to aim towards the Hamiltonian formulation. But obviously for covariance and symmetry principles, this is unbeatably simple and nicely covariant. So the action principle, when we fully spell it, when we spell it out fully, is this. Zero is the S by d phi, and then the S by d phi is literally the Newton-Leibniz limit, where the action is taken with the shifted phi, where this is a Dirac delta in 4D now, minus the unshifted, the action with the unshifted phi. And if there are any space and time derivatives, that will be picked up in this formulation automatically. So for example, here's the action for the Klein-Gordon field. Now this is an integral over R4, d4x. And we have here the time derivative of phi squared minus the space derivative squared minus m squared. Remember that the Hamiltonian had only a three-dimensional space derivative, and it was time-dependent. But the action is a functional that where nothing depends on time. It just outputs a number. You input a field configuration, and you output a number. Well, and then we can calculate what the equations of motion are directly from that action. For example, we can use the action principle and the first principle definition of what the functional derivative is. Or we can take the other Lagrange equations that we derived. Either way, we obtain that the Klein-Gordon equation is this. Second time derivative of phi minus Laplacian phi plus m squared phi is equal to 0. And this term, second time derivative minus Laplacian, is also written as the box operator, the so-called D'Alembertian. Now, a definition that is also quite useful is that of the Lagrangian density. So let us consider our action functional S for the Klein-Gordon theory. And then let us look at what is being integrated over. So just this part here. this piece here. That is not the Lagrangian. That is the Lagrangian density. If you integrate it over space, then you obtain the Lagrangian. So the unintegrated integrand, not integrated over space, nor over time, that is the Lagrange density. Now, often you will find in papers and in textbooks that the equations of motion are these. But it's really the action that we functionally differentiate. And even though I'm quite sloppy with the d's and the dels, I think these should be the Kronecker. This should be the deltas for functional differentiation.
But, but if you have a Lagrangian density, you're not functionally differentiating anymore.
Exactly, yeah, it makes no sense, yeah. Right?
But this is just a formal thing, right?
Yeah, it's sort of formal in the sense that it's incorrect and people don't care. Because the correct way to do it is to replace the L by the S. This has to be S in order for, you know, the L the L depends on x. If you differentiate with respect to phi of y, then the whole thing depends to an x and y. So that's not what we want. We want that everything just depends on one variable x. So L should be integrated. So this should be the action here. That should be the action there. And these should be functional derivatives. And then everything is fine. I'm just saying, you will see it in this notation too. Everybody knows how to evaluate it, but it's not correct by first principles. Another thing about notation. We will do a lot of derivatives, d by dx mu. And Einstein already introduced the notation that these derivatives could be abbreviated by just writing phi comma mu. And when indices occur twice, then of course you know that this is the Einstein summation convention and they will be summed over from 0 to 3. Okay, now let us perform the next step. We want to go to general relativity. So for that, let's put everything into the formulation of special relativity and then upgrade that to general relativity. I'm of course assuming,
Y minus 2.
What?
Minus 2 signature.
You're using mostly negative conventions.
Yes, sorry about that. Well, I'm following the convention of the text by Mukhanov and Vinitsky there. Otherwise, you'd be translating between those two things all the time. I didn't know that people are so emotionally attached to this. It used to be an East Coast, West Coast thing in North America. Yeah.
What? Which coast like the other signature better?
Isn't that the one that Einstein used? So that would be the East Coast.
I personally prefer like mostly positive, and I don't like that comma notation.
Yeah, I like the mostly positive too. Yeah. But the thing is that, you know, if you don't like some words in Spanish, you still have to use the words that Spanish use, right? I mean, it's the same here. Relativists will use a certain language, and you know, it's just.
We can use all plus. We can use all plus.
Well, all plus, that would be great. Oh, that would be nice. Yes. Okay, so let us define the metric tensor. I'm assuming, of course, that all of you have taken some form of general relativity. But just so that we're on the same page, let me relatively quickly breeze through this, how we get from special and then to general relativity. So we define the metric tensor in this way, eta mu nu. And then using these definitions, the Klein-Gordon action takes now this form. So here's the g mu nu. In principle, eta mu nu is this fixed matrix. But we will allow this to be more general than that in a moment. And we will call it g mu nu of x and t then. So for now, we are working with a Cartesian inertial coordinate system. And then this is the metric in special relativity. And our action, therefore, can be written in this way with the metric in here. I should say that the metric with the upper indices is the matrix inverse of the metric with the lower indices. In this case, it makes absolutely no difference, but later on, there will be a difference between the two. Okay, so now the equations of motion. Here they are again. Can now be written using the metric notation in this way. Minus m squared phi equal to the derivative of the metric of the derivative of phi. And that is, of course, just the Klein-Gordon equation again. All of this is still in an inertial coordinate system with Cartesian coordinates. So we are here now. We've completed the step one. We are here in the Lagrangian formalism. Everything is in terms of the action. It's special relativity. And we haven't quantized the fields yet. They're all just still number value. Now we want to move on to general relativity. Still not quantized. Okay, so how do we allow for curvature in space-time? The strategy will be this. Within special relativity, we will, first of all, free ourselves from the requirement of using rectangular coordinates. So we will stay within just Minkowski space, just flat space for the beginning, but we allow ourselves arbitrary coordinate system. You can use a coordinate system that you know, swirls around, rotating and accelerating and whatnot. Totally arbitrary. You move from variables x0, x1, x2, x3 to new variables x mu tilde that could be arbitrary functions, well, invertibly, differentiably, invertibly. You change coordinates to tilde variables that could be any other coordinate system. We allow ourselves that first. And then once we have our theory formulated in such a way that we can allow arbitrary coordinate systems, then it will be relatively easy also to introduce curvature. So our first aim is to allow arbitrary coordinate systems in Minkowski space. Let us reconsider the Klein-Gordon action. Here it is with the metric. Still it is eta mu nu, and here are the space and time derivatives, d by dx mu, d by dx mu. What happens if we change to arbitrary coordinates? So if we go from untilded variables to tilded variables by choosing some functions, so you know, we get to choose four arbitrary functions. The new time coordinate as a function of the old time and space coordinates, the new x1 coordinate, x tilde 1, as a function of the old untilded coordinates, and so on. We get to choose four functions freely. Not entirely freely. We want them to be differentiable and the whole thing to be invertible. But apart from that, pretty arbitrarily. Then what happens? If we change coordinate system, then our function phi of x, because it is scalar, simply goes into a function phi tilde of x tilde, which is the old phi of x, but the x evaluated at x tilde. That's the point of having a scalar. Its amplitude is literally the same at every point of the manifold before or after change of coordinate. You just have to evaluate it at the new point, at the new coordinates. Not the new point, the new coordinate. And what happens with the derivatives? Here we have space and time derivatives. If we change coordinates, then what happens to d by dx mu of phi? Well, that goes into d by dx tilde mu of phi tilde of x tilde. We can work that out. What is this? D by dx tilde of phi tilde is d by dx of phi of x of tilde, of x tilde. So we can differentiate d by dx of phi and then dx by dx tilde. So overall, you see, it's intuitively you can see that the chain rule factor, this is a chain rule factor such that overall this is the derivative with respect to dx tilde. So the d by dx tilde is the d by dx up to this chain rule factor matrix. And remember that we have that the index nu occurs twice, so it is being summed over without specifying a summation symbol. Okay, so the field just goes over into itself. The coordinates do this, and derivatives do that. Now, what we need is that the action, which is after all just a number, you plug in a field, you get out a number, that number needs to be the same independently of what coordinate system you choose to evaluate it in. So what we have to do is transform the metric, the g mu nu, in an appropriate way. You see, the derivatives of phi change in a particular way. They get matrices in front of them, this chain rule factor matrices. Here the phi doesn't change, but these guys change. And so in order to undo that, in order for this to be the same as before the change of coordinates, we need that the g mu nu also changes with a matrix with two matrix factors that will just undo the two chain rule matrices that we get for the derivatives of phi. So what we have to do is transform the metric g mu nu into a metric g mu nu tilde of x tilde with these two factors in front, so that this term in the action is numerically invariant. Namely, if we take g times the derivatives of phi, then that gets mapped under the change of coordinates into g tilde, and then the tilde derivatives of the phi of the x tilde variables. And these two can be expressed in terms of the old derivatives, but with these chain rule factors. And this metric can be expressed in terms of the old metric, but again with these two factors that we introduced here by definition. And then what we obtain is that, for example, these two chain rule factors, this one from here and that one from the metric, these two chain rule factors have a dx tilde nu here, dx tilde nu there. So those two cancel out, and you're just left with the d by dx epsilon by dx, d by dx beta, which gives you a Kronecker delta in epsilon and beta. And similarly here, you have the this mu and that mu, they just cancel, and you have just the Kronecker delta in rho and in alpha here. So overall, this is just two identity matrices. And therefore, we obtain that this term under change of coordinates goes into itself. Therefore, it is a scalar. So what we've learned from that is that the metric tensor has to transform in a particular way to guarantee that the Lagrangian density stays the same. Now, we use the terminology that because we are transforming the metric tensor in this way, with the two upper indices in this way, we say that it is a contravariant tensor of rank 2. If it had the indices down, we would call it a covariant vector and a covariant tensor, and then it would have to have the matrices with the opposite, the inverse matrices. Okay, so the relationship between the metric with the upper indices and the metric with the lower indices, I already mentioned that to you, they're just matrix inverses of another. And because of that, as I just mentioned, the transformation property of the G with the upper indices induces the transformation property of the G with the lower indices, because overall, you need that relationship is maintained. That's why if the metric with the upper indices transforms one way, the metric with the lower indices has to transform with the inverse matrices. Okay, so we have made sure now that the Lagrangian density is scalar, doesn't change under change of coordinate system. Does that mean that our action is now coordinate system independent? Unfortunately not. Doesn't mean that yet. And the reason is that when you have an integral over space and time and you change coordinates, then you get an integral over the new coordinates, the tilted coordinates, but also a chain rule factor. It's actually not called a chain rule factor, even though that's its origin, but it's a so-called Jacobi determinant, right? So every change of coordinates in a multidimensional integral comes with a Jacobi determinant. And that Jacobi determinant depends generally on space and time. So it does matter whether or not we have that factor here. But we want a formulation of the action that is one and the same no matter what coordinate system we choose. No coordinate system should be preferred. So what that means is that we need a term in the action which will observe, which will transform under change of coordinates in such a way that it produces a term that is just the inverse of that term. So that as we change coordinates, that newly to be introduced term transforms, the integration measure transforms in this way, but altogether they just cancel another out, and therefore the action takes the same form before and after the change of coordinate. So we need to introduce something into the action now, which obeys two conditions. There should not be any modification in Cartesian coordinates, because we know the physics in Cartesian coordinates. So whatever we introduce now into the action should be something that is just neutral, like a factor of one in Cartesian coordinates. In other coordinates, it could be different. But in Cartesian coordinates, we can't mess with the theory. We know what it is. So it needs to be something that's harmless in Cartesian coordinates. And in non-Cartesian coordinates, it should transform in such a way that it just simply undoes this Jacobian factor. And here is what fits the bill. We can modify the action to include a so-called volume factor here, the square root of minus the determinant of g mu nu. See, the determinant of g mu nu is negative, so we put a minus sign in here to get something positive and then take the square root of that. So this is what is called a volume factor for reasons of differential geometry. And in the case of Cartesian coordinates, g mu nu is this matrix. And therefore, the square root of minus of the determinant of that matrix is simply 1. So we haven't modified the theory at all in Cartesian coordinates. That was one of our requirements. But what happens if we change coordinate system? Well, if we change coordinate system, then the square root of minus the determinant of g mu nu, and in short, we will simply write here the bars. So that's the absolute value of the determinant of g. So little g alone without indices is the determinant of g, and then the bars mean absolute value of that. It turns out that the square root of the determinant of g transforms into the square root of the determinant of g tilde, which is the old square root of the determinant of g times the determinant of this matrix. But beautifully, that is just the inverse of the other matrix, the one that we need to compensate. So now we have, therefore, in special relativity, that the action S of phi of a field phi comes out the same number independently of any choice of coordinate system that you may make. So let's prove this. We have that the action is a functional of phi, which we can also write as a functional of phi tilde in the new coordinate. So in the new coordinates, we get a Lagrangian density with a tilde above it. The metric has a tilde above it, and so on. And now let's express everything in terms of the untilded quantities. And what we have then is that the measure factor here, that the d4x tilde acquires that factor here. But we also have that the square root of g comes with a prefactor. But the product of two determinants is the determinant of the product of the matrices. And these matrices, this tilde needs to be down here. See, it's the product of these two matrices. And the position of the tilde is not right. So it's this matrix times that matrix. And you see that these cancel here, and you just get a Kronecker delta. So it's the determinant of the identity matrix. Here it is. And so overall, that's just a 1. And therefore, overall, that's just the action again. So S tilde of phi tilde is S of phi. So let's just enjoy for a moment what that means. It means that we can now write down a classical Klein-Gordon theory in such a way that we can calculate in any arbitrary coordinate system what the action is for a particular field. So the field assigns to every location in space and time a value. And then, independently of what coordinate system we choose, that's going to be described by a function. And we plug that function into this functional, into the action functional, we get a number out of it, totally independently of the coordinate system. The action always takes the exact same form. There is no preferred coordinate system anymore. Okay, there's nothing special now about Cartesian coordinates. And in particular, we can now ask which field evolutions are extremizing the action. And the question, as well as the answer, as well as the answers, will have nothing to do with the choice of coordinate system. We're just talking about field configurations, right? A field configuration can be represented in many different coordinate systems. But that's irrelevant in here, because the action is always the same, no matter what coordinate system you choose. So it's a very elegant, covariant way of writing everything. So finally, then, we are ready to allow curvature. Let's see, how can we do this? We started out with a trivial metric. And by trivial, I mean it's Minkowski space, there is no curvature, and we choose Cartesian coordinate. In this case, the metric, g mu nu of x, is can be written as eta mu nu, and it's just this matrix here. Now, if we change coordinates, let's say we want a coordinate system that's behaving like a spiral. So that coordinate system rotates in a time-dependent way, and it might even have some expansion and some shrinkage in it. Some wild coordinate system in which space and time get all mixed up, like in a carousel or something. If we choose such a coordinate system, then the metric tensor will take a rather non-trivial looking shape. It will be a 4x4 matrix, as it always is, but it won't look like this at all. Instead, the g mu nu will transform. Remember, where is the transformation law for the metric? Yes, here. So we have that the metric, which we might start out with in Cartesian coordinates in Minkowski space, it's just eta mu nu. After we choose some wild coordinate system in Minkowski space, the metric now takes a different form. Namely, g tilde now in this wild coordinate system, in the tilted coordinate system, is the eta mu nu multiplied with those two matrices. And that means that the new matrix is some complicated thing, generally with no zeros in anywhere. It's still going to be a symmetric matrix because the eta mu nu is symmetric. It's symmetric under interchange of the two indices. And then it's being multiplied, each index is multiplied with the same matrix. So the outcome is still a symmetric matrix. But it's going to look very non-trivial. And we can ask, how non-trivial can it get? So we said we start with a trivial metric, and then we choose a generic coordinate system that is somehow wild. Then the g mu nu of x is some non-trivial matrix. And we can ask, can you get every symmetric matrix this way? Imagine somebody gives you a symmetric matrix there, and then asks, well, can you find a coordinate system that will get you there, so that you get this symmetric matrix? Can you always do that? No, you cannot. It turns out that by starting from the eta mu nu, if you start from the eta mu nu, and then allow yourself arbitrary differentiable, invertible changes of coordinates, so-called diffeomorphisms. If you allow yourself arbitrary diffeomorphisms, then you get a huge class of matrix-valued functions g mu nu of x, but not all of them. You don't get all of the symmetric 2x2 4x4 matrices. You don't get all of them. All those that you do get still describe the exact same physics. They still describe a Klein-Gordon field. They just describe Minkowski space, right? But what about symmetric matrices that cannot be obtained from the eta mu nu? We just said there will be, and later we'll prove that there are, and why, and how many. But let's just take it for granted that there are. Then what do they describe? So there could be, for example, a matrix g mu nu of x, a matrix valued function g mu nu of x. And no matter what diffeomorphism you try, no matter what change of coordinates you try, And let's say you try all of them. Impossible, right? But if you tried all of them, you would find none of them. No change of coordinates gets your metric in that form. Now, when that happens, then you're describing a curved space-time. Now, again, when that happens, then you have a curved space-time, which you can look at in an arbitrary coordinate system. Remember when we start with the eta mu nu metric? We can apply all possible diffeomorphisms to this, all possible differentiable changes of coordinates, and we get a huge class of symmetric matrices. And that's an equivalence class. It's an equivalence class of metric functions, in the sense that any two of those are just related by a change of coordinates. So this entire equivalence class describes just one thing, Minkowski space. Now, if you take another metric, one which cannot be put into this form, it too has an equivalence class. Any metric you write down has an entire class of matrix-valued functions that are obtained from another by changing coordinates, by diffeomorphisms.
The different functions within an equivalence class is related by a gauge transformation?
Actually, that's an yes. You can use the terminology that's the gauge transformation. That's right. Even though it's not a gauge transformation
right,
in the sense of particle physics.
In the sense of a scalar function of space. Right?
That's right, yes. But in the generalized sense of choosing a different member in a gauge equivalence class. Yes. Okay, so what we see here is that the set of metrics is naturally partitioned into diffeomorphism equivalence classes. And each one of those describes a space-time. So a space-time is described by an equivalence class of metrics.
Shouldn't you say that it's described by an equivalence class of matrices instead of metrics? Because a metric is something that's in the...
No, that's right. It's an equivalence class of matrix-valued functions. That's correct. The metric itself you can view as being the invariant thing there. And by the way, when we discuss the path integral, remember we discussed that if we do quantum field theory with the path integral, we are formally summing over all field evolutions phi of x and t. And if we wanted to quantize gravity now, then if we try to do that with a path integral, we are tempted to write down a formal path integral where we sum over all space-times. Space-time could be this, space-time could be that, could be Minkowski space, could be some other curved space, could be a space with a black hole, and so on.
But you need to quotient out the equivalence class, right?
Exactly. And that's what makes quantum gravity so hard. It's one of the reasons why it is so hard. That's because it is super difficult to check whether two arbitrary matrix-valued functions, g mu nu of x, are or are not in the same gauge equivalence class. How do you even check that there exists or doesn't exist a diffeomorphism between the two? If you generate them, you know there is one, right? You take your matrix-valued function and then apply a diffeomorphism to it, then you know, yeah, the result is in the same gauge equivalence class. But if you're just given two different matrix-valued functions, there's no easy way of telling whether they are or are not in the same gauge equivalence class, where they are obtainable from another by a mere change of coordinates or not. In other words, it's very difficult to find out whether the two matrix-valued functions, g mu nu of x, describe the same space-time or not. And that makes it super hard to do a path integral, because what we should path integrate over is space-time, not matrix-valued functions. Because matrix-valued functions contain information about two things. Matrix-valued functions, g mu nu of x, contain information about the shape of space-time, its curvature, but they also contain information about our choice of coordinates. And if we sum over all of those matrix-valued functions, we are in effect quantizing not only the shape of space-time, but also our choice of coordinate system. But that makes no sense, to quantize our choice of coordinate system. That's not something dynamical. So we'd like to pick out of each gauge occurrence cluster one representative, and that's super difficult to do. Okay, so what we saw is that if we start with eta mu nu, then allow ourselves an arbitrary change of coordinates, then we get the gauge equivalence class of Minkowski space. So Minkowski space matrix is this. In Cartesian coordinates, it's that in arbitrary coordinates. All right, we already discussed this. Right, so the question we asked is whether any function, any matrix valued function rho mu nu of x can arise from eta mu nu, and no, the answer is no, there are metrics that are not gauge equivalent to the to eta mu nu. And these others describe curved spacetimes. Okay, so a given spacetime a given spacetime is an equivalence class of metric functions g mu nu of x. And in order to describe such a spacetime, you can pick any representative out of that gauge equivalence class. You can choose any coordinate system you want to describe your spacetime. Now let us do a quick estimate, and that's the last thing we'll do today. Let us do a quick estimate of how big these equivalence classes are. When you're given a matrix-valued function g mu nu of x, how much of the information in there? You see, it's a each matrix element is a non-trivial function. How much of that information encoded in those non-trivial functions g mu nu of x, how much of that information is really information about the shape of space-time? And how much of it is just choice of coordinates? It's information about us rather than nature. Well, let's see. How many degrees of freedom does a metric have on the surface of it? Well, there's g mu nu of x, which is, let's say, space-time is n-dimensional. So it has one time dimension and n minus one space dimensions. So our space-time is presumably four-dimensional, n equals four. Let's say we have a metric that's a 4x4 matrix, or more generally, n by n matrix. Then how many matrix elements does an n by n matrix have? Well, n squared. But these guys are symmetric. So it's not really n squared. Instead, how many is it? Well, let's see. We have, if that's the metric, we have all the elements on a diagonal. And we have one off diagonal. We have the upper triangular, for example, right? So how many diagonal elements do we have? Well, n of them, okay? And how many entries do we have above the diagonal, for example? Well, so we take n squared matrix elements in total. We subtract the number of diagonal terms and then divide that by 2. And that is how many are up here. Right? So the total number of degrees of freedom of functions that we have in such an n by n matrix is this plus n, right? So plus n. So overall, we have n times n plus 1 half. Okay? So that's how many we have initially. Just considering that the metric is a symmetric matrix. But then much of the information, it looks in principle as if every one of those independent functions in the in this matrix valued function tells us something about space-time. But that's not so, because by changing coordinates, we can mess with those numbers, right? When we change coordinates, we have the freedom to define new variables. We used to have n variables x mu. But then, after change of variables, we have new variables x tilde mu of the old variables x. I don't put an index here because it's x0 to x3 or xn minus 1. So we get to choose how many? We get to choose n new functions. So for example, take the metric. Somebody gives you a metric. And let's say you look at one particular matrix element in here. And you want it to have the value 5. Just for the heck of it, you want it to be 5. You can do that. You can do it because you have a lot of freedom. You get to choose n new coordinates. And if everything is n-dimensional, you get to choose n functions. You get to choose the function x tilde 0 of the old variables. You get to choose the function x tilde 1 of the old, etc., x tilde n of the old variables. You get to choose n functions. And all of those n functions will enter into g tilde. So if this is g mu nu, or g mu nu of x is equal to this, then g tilde mu nu of x tilde is, and then remember we have the med, we have, no, no, not this, we have dx dx tilde dx tilde, and then we have g, well, alpha beta or something, right? So we get to choose what these matrices are, because we get to choose what the change of coordinates are. So we get to choose those matrices, and with a little care, you can arrange these things to be such that you can impose a condition, like a particular matrix element should be 5. But how many conditions generally do you get away with? How many things can you change in here?
N.
That's right. Generally, you can change n things. But that means that of this many degrees of freedom that we identified in the matrix-valued function, just because it's symmetric, not all of them are real. We need to subtract n of them, because that's as much information as there is in the choice of metric as we put in there. Right? So n of those degrees of freedom, we get to choose by choosing our coordinate system. So the metric contains information about the space-time, but it also contains information about our choice of coordinates. And this is as much as it is. And so therefore, that's the actual number of degrees of freedom in a space, in a metric. Now, how much is that? So for example, if n is equal to 2, so it's a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time, how many degrees of freedom do we have then? 1. Right. And for n equals 3, for a 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time. 3, right? And for n equal 4, 6, that's right. Okay. So an interesting observation here is that for a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time, it is as if curvature was scalar, as if the metric was scalar, because there's only one degree of freedom. Even though it looks like there are more, it looks like there are 3. Without this, it would be 3, but it's not. Most of what is in a 2x2 matrix is actually just our choice of coordinate. But then in higher dimensions, we see that there is actually non-trivial information in the metric. Oh, actually put it here, right? Yeah. All right, that's as far as we got today. I think we're ready now to do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formulation and then quantize the whole thing. Okay? See you on Friday.